I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. And when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Epochs number 115. This week we're going to be talking about Black Wednesday and I'm joined by Dan. How are you, Dan?
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting story if you're interested in the history of finance and money and markets and all sorts of things. It's a story really when John Major tried to take on the German economy and George
reality,
Soros,
yes.
and the foreign exchange markets, and failed terribly.
I think this one is even bigger than, you know, just finance and markets and stuff like that. I think this was a really pivotal moment, and I mean, I've got a couple of reasons for that. I mean, for a start, it gave George Soros an enormous war chest. Now, if you think about all the downstream effects of that, I mean, you've got George Soros today who's funding these far left prosecutors all over the United States who are not enforcing actual laws, but instead using their tenure to go after political opponents. So that, and everything else that George Soros is funding. So that is hugely damaging. And he got his wealth from this day. And there are other things. I mean, what this did is it set the conservatives on a path to ruin that resulted in them becoming basically another left-wing party in the image of Blair. That was a path that I think started on this day. Mm-hmm. And another one, of course, it significantly helped Blair with his 1997 landslide win and all of the damage that the Dark Lord did to this country. So the social fabric of the United Kingdom, the mass immigration that we've seen, a lot of that was made possible from the downstream effects of this. Mm. So it is a momentous impact for what it had, for what, you know, the downstream effects were. The only positive thing I can point to on this is that it did give you know, sort of rockets under the Eurosceptic movement. Mm. And probably because of the events of this day was why we never joined the euro and ended up losing the pound. So it's not all bad, but this is a big one.
It's a pivotal thing, right? Yeah, it's much more than just a bad day on the markets.
Yes.
It's a bit more than just an embarrassment for John Major.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there may be ever so slightly playing down the positives or potential positives a long way down the road, but you could say it sort of, well, it definitely sort of split the Tory party. It made the Eurosceptics have a lot more power. We basically didn't, for one reason or another, very much helped the argument why we shouldn't join the euro. Mm. And you could, I think, definitely make the argument that it ultimately ended in the Brexit referendum. That even, what, decades later, because this is in 92, September 1992, decades later, Cameron felt the need to try and once and for all draw a line under it within the Tory party.
Mm.
And so I've heard it called White Wednesday.
Because yes, I suppose you could look at it like that.
Because it saved us from joining the euro and ultimately getting our sovereignty back.
Because, I mean, I talked about it on the effects of the Tory party, but of course, you know, it cast a long shadow over Gordon Brown. So Gordon Brown would not, when he became Tony Blair's chancellor, he would not take us into the euro because of the, you know, the long shadow of the events of that day. Now, before that, you know, the European project, it was just grumbling along. It was just something that was happening in the background, much like it was in those European countries, where, you know, it was just something that happened year after year. And it was only after this that we sort of, it was like being splashed with cold water. It's like, okay, well, maybe we need to reconsider some of this Europeanism. So, yeah, I'll accept that, you know, from some perspectives, you could actually say that this was a good thing, although I think the negatives are also really powerful.
Oh, yeah. Like George Soros, his globalist goals had to take a back seat for a moment if it meant he could make £1 billion in one day.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, back then he was in money mode. I mean, I think the political activism was relatively muted at that point. The thing is, you take £1 billion back in 1992, even if you just go by the official numbers, that's £3 billion today. But actually, the thing is, if you need to apply a return on investment to that. So, for example, my career return on investment is something like 26%, which is all right, but I was doing...
Bloody great.
Yeah, but well,
to be fair, without being too sycophantic, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So if you were to apply a return on investment to that, to £1 billion in 1992, you'd have over £1 trillion at this point.
Right.
Now, actually, the more money you manage, the harder it gets to get a good return on it. But even still, he is an incredibly wealthy man. He's worth hundreds of billions. And a lot of that would have been really boosted by that. And of course, and these days, so his son, I mean, we just learned that Soros is basically handing over the empire to not his eldest son, but his more political son. So this is going to be an enormous war chest. I mean, we've got a left-wing organization out there with funding power equivalent to medium-sized governments whose objective is to destroy the social fabric of the Western of the Western civilization as fast as it possibly can. Yeah. And that's coming from the money that Soros made.
Yeah. Because people might, you know, these days, Zoomers or people that just don't know the backstory of George Soros might think of him as just this, he's just a billionaire that just exists in the world. But first and foremost, he was a trader, like a fund manager.
Oh, he was a really, really good one.
He was great at it, to be fair to him. One of the greatest traders of all time. I mean, the ability to sort of see the future or predict what was coming, he was great at it, because there's the Soros Fund Management Group, or there's a larger group that Soros Fund Management was involved in. But anyway,
the Quantum Fund.
That's it, Quantum. Yeah. So even though he made about $1 billion, I'll get into this later when we get into the actual details of exactly what went down and all the numbers and everything. He made about £1 billion or dollars. Makes a big difference, actually. Anyway, about $1 billion in profit. But he was exposed to something like $10 billion. So...
Yeah, he would have leveraged it up.
Yeah, he leveraged everything he possibly could, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Soros has written a book on investing, which I really must read at some point, because even though he is distilled evil, he's still a bloody good trader. He still knows his business.
Yeah.
So I must read that book and just try and put aside in my head the you know, the fact that I'm reading the words of Beelzebub. But yeah, he is a fantastic trader.
I think I've said this before somewhere. I think that the difference between successful people, and this isn't necessarily to do with intelligence or anything or wisdom, but just whether you're a success in the world, is whether you're able to see a few steps ahead. So for example, someone that can't stop going into prison because they just rob a liquor store, go to prison for that, come out and rob a liquor store again. Like, they're not looking one step ahead.
Yeah.
Right? And then there's normal people that just exist in the world. And then there's people like yourself or George Soros or any good manager. I you're seeing many steps ahead.
Yeah.
Correctly.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the difference between me and George Soros. It's not so much that we can both look ahead and see the future. The difference between me and him is that he gets there a few days earlier than I do,
right?
And that makes all the difference. It really does. If you can get there a couple of days quicker than the rest of the market, you're going to capture like 80-90% of the returns. So even though when I sit down and do my brokenomics, I think that I'm, you know, putting out the right stuff about, you know, where we're going. To be fair, if I could run that same thought process by looking at a news article and get there within half an hour and then place a trade, you know, to be fair, I'd probably be running one of the world's largest hedge funds. It's not so much the destination. It's how quickly you get there.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that's why great traders on all sorts of things, not just the money markets, not just foreign currencies, but anything really, equities or commodities or anything, they find a bit of news or a new bit of information and sort of immediately calculate what that means for the price.
I mean, I can give you a really good example. I mean, there was one fantastic, I can't remember the name of the chap now, will come to me in a minute, but do you remember when those 4G licenses came out, when government started auctioning off 4G, you know, the thing on your phone, which we're moving away now to 5G. But 4G licenses came out whenever it was, like 15 years ago. And the UK government decided that they, instead of just selling them, they were going to auction them to the highest bidder. Now, that news came out, and one hedge fund manager, he looked at that and he thought, hang on a minute, all of these phone companies, they are going to have to, the game incentives is they have to bid up to the highest level that they possibly can. All of these companies are running with massive debt. They don't have big cash burden, cash piles. It's going to basically bankrupt the telecoms industry. So he saw that news article, and you know, within the space of an afternoon, he figured out the downstream effects of it, and he was shorting the telecoms industry. He made an absolute fortune. Now, again, you know, I would have got there eventually. I wouldn't have got it the same afternoon as the news came out, and that's why he's running a hedge fund worth, you know, many hundreds of billions. So yeah, that the ability to see and the speed of it is what makes a difference, and Source was brilliant at that.
There's few people that can do it. So for example, where I mentioned is, and it's in an indirect sense, it was John Major against against Soros. It's much more than that.
So politicians, they are so far down.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
The ability to do this stuff.
That was the point I was going to make. Yeah.
They're not even playing the same sport.
Yeah, in that battle of abilities to see into the future, John Major was absolutely outclassed by not just Soros, but all sorts of fund managers, all sorts of people that are in the money markets at that time. Yeah. He was way, way, way behind. I think John Major, just to say this to get it out there, I think he's extremely dull-witted. I think he's a dull-witted person. I'd even go so far as to say he's almost stupid. Some of the decisions he makes in this, when we go through it, it's going to be like, why did you think that, John? Sorry, Sir John, sorry.
Yeah.
He's a Knight of the Garter, isn't he?
Yeah.
What made you think that, John? Like, why haven't you changed your mind now this new bit of information's come out? Explain yourself.
I mean, the skill set and incentives of politicians is just completely different. If you're a trader,
that is the answer, isn't it? There's that.
Yeah, if you're a trader, you need to have strong convictions, but they must be very loosely held. You must abandon those convictions on the drop of a hat. Otherwise, you're going to lose all of your money. But politicians, because it's not their own money they're spending, it's taxpayers' money. Mm. You know, they can be pig-headed. And actually, most of the time it works because there's always more taxpayers' money, or they can print it. Mm. They can get away with it. And actually, one of the lessons perhaps from this day is perhaps if he had been even more pig-headed, he might have been able to get through it. You know, maybe if they just kept on firing the billions at it and they just didn't care what it costs, eventually they could have beaten the market. I mean, Japan has done this for years. They have taken. I mean, every so often you get a George Soros type who thinks I'm going to take on the Bank of Japan, and I'm going to break their yield curve control. Every time it's a widowmaker trade because they just like, nope, we are not moving. Whereas, possibly to their credit, they realized that they were hiding to nothing on this one, and they let it go. But they could have kept on firing billions and billions at it, and maybe the government's policy could have remained irrational for longer than the traders could have remained solvent.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's difficult to know.
I mean, I don't think the Bank of England definitely didn't have an endless reserve of foreign currency. Because if you're going to buy a pound, if you're going to buy a sterling, you have to do it with either gold or just other foreign currencies you've got. Yeah. So we had a finite amount of dollars and yen mainly.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, you could have got creative with I don't know, something like if they had swap lines back then to another.
If you really wanted to.
Yeah. I'm not saying they could have done, but at least they let it go when they did.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah. Shall we get into the detail of it then? So what happened? So the day, Black Wednesday, is the 16th of September 1992. And basically, the pound lost a great deal of its value on that day. That's basically the story. But I want to go back.
Yeah, you need to start with the ERM, don't you?
Yeah. So the story is really about, it's about Europe and about the ERM. the exchange rate mechanism. So I want to go back to just very briefly, just a few minutes really, just talk about some of the earlier things that happened in the European project of unification and sort of the, very broadly speaking, the economy of the 70s and 80s. So now we've got like the EU, haven't we? But that wasn't sort of formally come about until the Maastricht Treaty, which is like, what, 1992. So before that, and even now, there's many layers of...
Was it still the EEC?
It was the EEC then,
right,
yeah.
The European Economic Community.
That's it, right.
So it was more of an economic club.
That's
than
it.
It was a political project, but nothing like what it is today.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So there's a few different layers of it, isn't there? There's sort of the European Council, and there's all sorts of things in the Schengen zone. Nowadays, I mean, there's all sorts of sort of layers and levels to the governance and bureaucracy to it. But there was less of it back then. But John Major signed the Maastricht Treaty in, I think, 1992. It was just a little bit before this.
It was Thatcher who took us into the ERM, wasn't it? But John Major was Chancellor while Thatcher was Prime Minister, and Thatcher was resolutely against it. But Major just wore her down and eventually got her against her better judgment to go into the ERM. And I think that was about 2 years before. That'd be about 1990.
Yeah. It was just before she left office, which was, if I remember correctly, it's right at the end of 1990 or the very beginning of 1991.
Yeah, right.
It's about then. I think the very end of 1990 is when Major replaced Thatcher. So just to say ever so quickly then that the European project to become a sort of super state, one thing I would say, it's a bit of my opinion, some people might be able to argue that what I'm about to say is wrong, but I think the project was always to be a full super state. I think, even in Brexit in 2016, some Remainers would try and make the argument that, oh, no, that's not what it is. That's not, I don't think that argument is remotely credible. I don't think probably in many other countries, they'd even try to make that argument.
Oh, yeah.
Like in France, they don't even try to make that argument, I don't think.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it's always been about the super state.
Yeah, right.
They've just been, you know, relatively careful not to make those arguments in English on English news channels.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's that guy who's active now, Guy Verhofstadt, who's always speaking on these things. You know, he has never made any bones about the fact that it is a European super state that he is driving towards, and not for this podcast, but then there's the whole world government agenda that has sort of been pushed by Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of that thinking that came out of the Second World War, which is the only way that we are going to achieve the sort of political unity we need is if absolutely everybody in the world is under one government. And the European superstate, as they like to see it, was a massive step on that road. So absolutely, that's what it was.
So when I say superstate, I mean one European government with one economy, one currency, one army, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's sort of the end goal. But you can't just immediately do that. So there had to be all these steps. There has to be all these steps to get the European nations to sort of abandon their own nationality and sovereignty. That project really started in the 50s. Anyway, by the 1970s, there was, quite a severe economic downturn for Britain, anyway, for Britain. Something like a mini depression, maybe is a bit strong, but certainly a long, prolonged, quite deep recession in the 1970s. And speaking with very, very broad strokes of the brush here. In the 80s, there was sort of a famous boom, if you like, the classic boom of the 1980s. But by the end of the 1980s, by the very early 1990s, again, there was a bit of a bust cycle. So it always goes in the cycles of boom and bust. So by the 90s, we had the sort of the heyday of the 80s was over. And we had very high interest rates, sort of 10, 11% interest rates, high unemployment. And high interest rates really hurts people trying to pay mortgages or trying to save money or exports. Trying to sell things abroad is very expensive, so people just don't buy
it. It has
them.
A lot of downsides, but it has positives for some people. So if you are a foreign central bank and you're thinking, okay, let's say you're, I don't know, Kenya or, you know, one of those sort of countries, your own currency is going to be is very variable, not that secure, and you're thinking, I want to hold reserves of some other currency. If you're putting it in sterling, well, sterling is a good brand. It's a very stable thing. And if you're getting 11% interest rates, that's a pretty good level of return for holding a currency in something which is fairly low risk like sterling. So, you know, it did all of those damaging things that you just said to the people in the country,
right.
But it would have helped contribute to quite a strong pound.
Right, yeah, okay.
Mm.
Yeah, so the value of the pound was quite high, though, relatively considering. So, yeah, it might be good for foreign investors or something, or foreign currency speculators. But for Britain, our own internal domestic economy was in really poor shape in the early 90s.
Good for importers because the pound buys you more. Right. Bad for exporters because the exchange rate the other people get is getting as low. But, of course, when we import goods, that means somebody else has made them. When we export goods, it's because we've made them. So, you want a reasonably strong currency, but you don't want it too strong.
It can certainly be too strong.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely, yeah. Because you just can't really export anything. You can't really sell things abroad. No one's prepared to buy it.
Yeah.
So just very broadly then, they got the bust of the 70s, the boom of the 80s, and then sort of the bust of the early 90s again, that the economy's sort of in the doldrums and that certainly our interest rates were very high. So in the Tory party, you've got, or had back then, sort of Eurosceptics and sort of pro-Euro people.
Not many, to be fair, back then.
Right. They sort of called them wets and dryers.
Yeah.
So Thatcher, though, herself, was sort of famously a fairly Eurosceptic. You know, the famous thing where she said no to a few different things that Mr. Delors wanted, that the European community sort of insisted we do and wanted from us. And she's just like, no, I'm not doing that.
Mm.
No, that's it. End of discussion, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to join the mechanism, you know, the exchange mechanism, and what that is, I suppose, in a nutshell, is that they wanted to peg the main currencies to the Deutschmark.
Mm.
What that means is, instead of having loads of different exchange rates between all the different, because this is pre-Euro, so all the different countries have got their own thing. Italy's still got the lira, Germany's got the Deutschmark. All the countries have got their own currencies. Instead of having, you know, 20, 30 different exchange rates, you peg your currency to the Deutschmark, which is the most stable one. That's what everyone thought.
It's basically a pilot project for the euro, because the euro is everybody has the same currency. It's one step towards that.
Yeah.
And the ERM mechanism was, okay, well, we're not going to have one currency, but we are going to make sure that the currencies are fixed against each other, so they don't move. So it is basically the same thing as having one
within
currency.
A small range, at least.
Yeah, a small range. Yeah. So, you know, the underpinnings of the EU project has always been Germany, because it's had the strongest economy. They had a lot of financial discipline because they had been through the Weimar Republic era and they had experienced hyperinflation. And it was seared onto the cultural memory that you must not let inflation get out of control. So they had a very hawkish and very independent central bank. And so they were, at the time, the kind of model for how you do monetary policy. So the rest of the European countries, and also Britain, thought, okay, well, what we're going to do is we are going to have a sort of proxy single currency type arrangement, where we are going to make sure that our currency does not move out of too. I mean, you can fluctuate a little bit, but not much away from the Deutschmark.
Mm.
So it's very much the pilot project for the euro.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Sort of some economists, because I'm not a true economist in any sense, but true economists say it's sort of an absolutely necessary first step before you go into a single currency.
One of the big takeaways from this whole thing that we're talking about now is that the pilot project was a failure.
And
yet they decided, oh, okay, the pilot project was a failure. Let's do the euro anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And you remember when Germany screwed over Greece in the last few years?
Mm.
Remember that, when Greece looked like they were going to default and Germany was like, well, we'll lend you all this money, but you'll have to be our, economically speaking, our bitch forever now.
Yeah. I mean, what
you've got no choice. How about that?
I mean,
it's like,
No wonder so many Greek people are leaving. They have been epically screwed over by Germany.
Who would want that for their country? Yeah. Well, we get screwed over. Italy gets screwed over by Germany in this story. Mm. The exchange rate mechanism. So you peg your currency to the Deutschmark. But what that means is, though, if the Bundesbank, the German central bank, raises or lowers its interest rate, you've sort of got to do it as well, or at least very closely mirror it.
On a practical day-to-day level, if you've decided that the Deutschmark and the pound have to trade at a similar level, on a practical day-to-day level, if more people are selling the pound or selling the Deutschmark than you want to, and the values of those two things start to move away, the central bank has to come in and start buying up pounds or Deutschmarks, whichever way they need it to go, to basically create artificial supply or demand to get them back in line. So on a day-to-day basis, it's a lot of buying and selling, of intervening in the market to push that peg back in line. And the sort of medium view is that you do what you just said, which is you match the interest rates so that, you know, people should not want to buy and sell. Because they should be roughly equal, and therefore there's no reason to buy and sell. So you put those two mechanisms together, and that's basically the functioning of the EOM.
So the problem with all of that is, just to sort of zoom out in economic terms at this moment in the story, the problem with all of that is that's loads of state intervention.
Mm.
Loads.
Yes.
So again, in the broadest economic theory terms, there's people like Keynesians, after John Maynard Keynes, who are for as much and any intervention at all times, whatever you need to do, do it.
Hmm.
And then there's sort of the Austrian school where they're like, sort of never do it, don't even have a central bank or whatever, you know, never ever.
Oh, that's where I am.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's people sort of in the middle, monetarists, the sort of Thatcher's government, some of her what was it, Jeffrey Howe, people like that, or sort of somewhere in the middle.
Hmm.
Right. But anyway, the point is, if you're going to join the ERM, then you're sort of locking yourself in to the government and your central bank, sort of constantly fiddling with interest rates and buying and selling currencies.
And the value of your currency, it should be a price signal. It should be telling you something about that country. If the value of your currency is falling, it tells you that the underlying factors of that economy are not performing. And if it's rising, it's telling you basically that country is doing well. So, I mean, it is an important price signal. And basically, what I mean by price signal is it's a reflection of reality.
Right.
So what the ERM project was is basically saying we can, by government fiat, suspend reality.
Right.
Which didn't work.
It's mad, right? At best, it's sort of naive or short-sighted or something. And at worst, it's sort of mad, right?
Is it at least hubristic?
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. Again, to be quite nice about it, it's a slippery slope.
Mm.
You're sort of almost certainly going to come a cropper at some point.
But it's the mindset the government can do what it wants.
Mm. Or it can manipulate world markets, currency markets anyway, just exactly as it needs to.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Because we talked about Soros sort of taking on the Bank of England or something. It's more than just Soros. He was just one of the big fish involved in it. It was it was all speculators. It was the currency markets,
the
biggest markets
banks
in the world.
Because I mean, this one, it was so bloody stunningly obvious. And I mean, I was just a young teen at the time. But I did participate in another one. So another one of these situations was when Gordon Brown decided he was going to sell off all the gold. And not only was he going to sell off all the gold, that he was going to announce in advance on the which day he was going to sell it. So I just looked at this and thought, okay, well, thank you for the free money.
Mm.
So I'll wait basically until the price gets pushed down. Then I'll go and buy a whole load of gold or gold options. I mean, I think I bought a whole load of warrants. And, you know, within a month, it's back up and sell them. It's like, okay, thanks for the deposit on the house. I mean, but if they're just going to hand you money, you know, you can take it. And the ERM was an even more extreme example of this. It was government policy basically saying to everybody in the city, would you like some cash?
Yeah. Buy some, borrow some pounds now.
Yeah.
Because you're going to
sell them.
Yeah. Short them now. Mm. and you're going to make some money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll get into the details of sort of exactly that, how exactly you make money by doing that in a bit. But just to say, this idea that in the Tory party, people considered, as you said, that the German economy was the most stable, and that you could sort of peg our currency to the Deutschmark. Mm. But we already had really high interest rate, sort of 10, 11%.
Yep.
So if for whatever reason, you hoped it was never really going to happen, but if for whatever reason, the Bundesbank did want to raise its interest rates, then you're forced to raise them too, which could be a tipping point. Like, you sort of can't raise them anymore for political reasons or just for economic reasons. You can't do it. It would tank your whole economy if you were to raise your interest rates anymore. But you've got to, because you're in the ERM.
Yeah.
So suddenly you're in a real trouble. And that's basically what happened.
And we joined it at a high rate.
Yeah, really high, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean if you were to plot on a chart the pound versus the Deutschmark, you know, you would see that line bob up and down, but you basically have two bands of, you know, it tends to go up to this level, it tends to go down to this level. It tends to bounce between that range. And basically what we did is we waited until we were at the top of that range and they said, right, that's the level we're going to lock in. Hmm. And you can kind of see the politicians wanted, because they want, oh yeah, we've got a strong currency. So you can see them wanting to lock in at that high rate. Hmm. But actually, it was folly. Oh, yeah. Because you should have picked the middle of the range.
Yeah. And apparently there was no negotiation about that. John Major just picked it.
Yeah.
And when they went to...
Because he didn't understand what he was doing.
Yeah, he's not an economist.
Yeah.
Despite being chancellor. That's one thing I find incredible, that quite often you get chancellors who are not economists, not even close.
Mm.
Not even close. Like maybe some of them, like Jeremy Hunt now, I think, did PPE. We might have done economics or something, or history of economics, but loads of chancellors are not economically savvy whatsoever.
Yeah. I don't think doing PPE will get you to the point of being that's economically
not enough,
savvy.
Is it? Yeah, you're not going to be... Like John Major, as this story exposes, doesn't seem to know what he's doing, really.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.